You know, I am all about those little pick-me-ups throughout the day. Whether it's conquering work tasks or doing chores around the house, I need a little treat to reward me. It is a must. And you know what gets me smiling every time? Japanese snacks. Not only are they bursting with flavor, but the cute packaging and quirky vibes add an extra layer of fun. That is why teaming up with Boxu, a Japanese snack subscription box, has been an absolute delight. And these aren't your run-of-the-mill grocery store snacks, okay? Every month, Boxu brings you over 20 unique treats that you can normally find only in Japan. Plus, they throw in a nifty guide packed with info about each snack and Japanese culture. So you get to snack while you learn? Are you kidding? This was literally made for me. Oh, and by the way, each box ships straight from Japan, straight to your door. Okay, so I'm going to try one of the snacks for you. I got my little guide right here. I think this week I'm going to go for the Soka Senbei Uma Zarame. This Senbei rice cracker boasts a uniquely irresistibly tart and sweet flavor combination of ume Japanese plum and zarame, a coarse granulated sugar. Cool. Now, this says it contains wheat and soy, so that's good to know for you gluten folks. There are plenty of gluten-free snacks in here. Here's the cracker. Ooh, this looks so good. Let me give it a try. Oh my God. You hear that crunch? It's like tart. It's a little salty. It's a little sweet. Mmm. This is delicious. Mmm. And I never would have gotten to try this if Boxu hadn't sent it straight to my house. Mm. And you know, my favorite thing about Boxu is that they support small family-run businesses in Japan. Boxu has sourced your treats by working with over 245 small makers in Japan, helping out their businesses and helping to preserve their traditions. So if you love trying new and interesting things, or if you know somebody who does, you have got to try out Boxu and get these snacks shipped straight from Japan to your door. And right now, you can use the code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's BOKKSU.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
I don't know the truth. I don't know the way. I don't know what to think. I don't know what to say. Yeah, but that's all right. Yeah, that's okay. I don't know anything.
Hello, welcome to Factually. I'm Adam Conover, and, you know, we've talked about labor unions on this show before in my episode with Stephen Greenhouse a month or two ago. Really recommend that one if you want an intro to the topic. But today, I want to talk about the labor union that I am a member of. See, back in 2007, you might remember, there was a writer's strike. You might remember this. Hollywood writers were on the picket lines. Remember that? All the late night shows went dark. Conan started spinning his ring on his desk. And all your favorite TV shows got like weird and bad for like a season or two. If you wondered why like the second season of Friday Night Lights sucked so much, like it seemed like all the episodes are kind of half written and they only really shot 2/3 of the season. Well, it's because the strike happened in the middle of the writing process. So that's exactly what happened. Now, look, sure, a couple of our nightly entertainments got a little bit weirder for a few months. But when I joined the Writers Guild, which I know sounds like it's from the Middle Ages, but I swear it is from this year in America. It's the Writers Guild of America. I realized that that strike was worth it because even though the idea of a bunch of TV writers on strike sounds weird, the truth is that they were fighting and continue to fight for the same respect and fair treatment as all workers are. And in fact, I think the WGA might just serve as an example for the way forward for labor in this country. See, the Guild is not a prototypical union. We're not hard hat guys in factories punching clocks and going to play cards at the union hall. But the industry we're in is clearly massively profitable. And the reason it is because of the labor of a relatively small group of people. The people who literally make the things that the entire rest of the business make money off of. So just as the workers who build your car deserve a fair share of the profits from selling that car, so does the writer whose work turned into a movie that earned $100 million, or the team of writers who built a beloved informational comedy show on a channel that used to be Court TV deserve their fair share as well. Especially those people, I think. Since the Guild started in 1933, writers have gone on strike to demand our fair share time and time again in 1952, 1960, 1973, and three times in the 80s, not to mention 2007. These strikes ensured that writers earned fair wages and royalties from their very lucrative work, but also the basic protections all workers need, like healthcare. And the Guild is still fighting for protections as basic as paid family leave. And through those years, the Guild has been there to make sure that as the entertainment industry shifts, whether to VHS, cable, or streaming, or whatever comes next, VR, direct-to-brain, hyper-immersive, wavelength transmission, all right? The point is, the Guild is there to ensure that the people who come up with that entertainment aren't left behind in the wheels of capitalism. The Guild demonstrates how powerful it can be when a union is willing and able to adapt with a rapidly changing industry. And here's another example of how the Writers Guild has something to say about labor in America today. We live in a world now in which worker organizing seems harder than ever, right? Gig economy workers, telecommuting programmers, the dude who brings you your DoorDash from Chipotle. It's often hard to imagine how individual workers who never have a reason to even talk to their peers might organize, right? Well, much like them, writers predominantly work alone, from gig to gig, banging away on laptops in seclusion. Yet somehow, they manage to create a union whose solidarity is so strong, it's able to take on some of the most powerful companies in America. That's right, I'm not talking about Amazon or Standard Oil. I'm talking about Disney. The Writers Guild goes toe-to-toe with the evil empire and occasionally even wins a round. So to talk about how they did it and what their example means to the future of labor and the entertainment industry, my guest today is Writers Guild West President David Goodman. But of course, he's not just a guild member, he's also a writer. He's worked on Family Guy, Star Trek Enterprise, and my personal favorite, The Golden Girls. Please welcome David Goodman. I mean, we did a really great episode a couple months ago with a writer named Stephen Greenhouse about, like, who's a journalist who's written about, like, the history of, like, unions, et cetera, et cetera. So I see this as a really good book. It's called Beaten Down, Worked Up.
Check it out.
Yeah. And so I think it's like, this is like a little bit of a follow-up. Now we're talking to an actual
union person.
An actual union boss. Do you conceive of yourself as a union boss?
You know, it was funny. During my re-election, one of the people who's running against me compared me to Jimmy Hoffa.
and The Irishman was about to come out.
It all seemed related. No, I do not. I mean, it's interesting. I think that the thing about being president of the union is, of this union, is you have no actual power.
How so?
I'm the spokesman for the guild. We can't do anything unless the members are on board. And so this idea that I could be a boss, a union boss, and tell everybody what we're doing and why we're doing and they don't have a choice, I mean, that's not our guild.
Yeah.
I can't do anything unless the members are on board. The only thing that I do along with staff and the rest of the leadership is educate, is like, look, we've seen this problem. We think it's related to this. We think we could do something about it.
But unions are often portrayed in the press as telling the workers what to do and limiting what the workers can, and like issuing edicts and things like that. And that's, in your view, a misconception.
Completely. I mean, I think that all unions sort of begin with a group of people, of workers, whatever industry they're in, deciding that they're going to get together and say, our interests are with each other, mm-hmm. our power is with each other, and we're going to try and make our lives better. I mean, the thing about what's so interesting about a union, you know, that idea of a union, that a union is out for itself in some ways is ridiculous. It doesn't make a profit. Nobody, all the leaders are in our union are volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the amount of time that I spend as president of the guild, I'm not getting a dime. So,
right.
So I don't have any interest other than improving the lives of our members and making sure they're being fairly compensated and treated well. And so that's, but because you're up against giant corporate interests, and that is again true with any union in any industry, they have an enormous advantage because they can paint you mm-hmm. the way they paint themselves, you know, the way they are, which is in some cases, they don't tell the truth. They are out for themselves. They are interested yeah. only in profit.
Yeah.
And so they, because whatever leverage we have being the workers, whatever, again, whatever industry that is, that the real bosses, the real employers are going to say they're bad. They're saying we're bad, but they're just as bad.
Yeah.
And it's not true.
And you see that with unions across the country, you see that pattern of messaging from the, you know, from the corporations versus, you know, mm-hmm. what you hear from the unions themselves. But you're a writer yourself, like, right?
Yes.
What are you writing right now? What are you working on right now?
I currently write for a show called The Orville, which is—
I've heard of this show.
Have you? Oh, that's good. I think a lot of people haven't.
Really? I find that show very popular.
Oh, okay, good.
In fact, I remember when that show came out and the new Star Trek came out, and I went to see, like, my cousins in Michigan who are like, that's a good way to test. I think every writer's got, like, that you go visit your family for the holidays.
Somewhere, yeah.
Yeah, and they were like— I was like watching the new Star Trek. I was like, "Are you like that?" They're like, "No, we don't like that show. The Orville, that's a really good show." And I was like, "Okay, then it's working, you know."
Yeah, you know, I've worked with Seth MacFarlane for Seth MacFarlane for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
I was on Family Guy for a number of years. I ran it with Seth for about 6 years and worked there after I ran it, and then done a lot of animation. I started on The Golden Girls was my first job.
I love The Golden Girls.
Yeah, it was a good show.
When that show's in reruns, I'm still like, I watch it. I'm like, the jokes are so good. It really is like up there with Friends or like any other sort of like super funny. Love the characters. Incredible show.
It was a great group of actresses.
Yeah.
Just great. Like I don't know if we've ever seen any, we'll ever see talent like that again in a group on a show. And then the writers, they're writing really funny jokes and I was very fortunate to have that as my first job. Also the first job I was fired from. So that's also
wow. How do you get fired from the Golden Girls?
Well,
and only if it's a good story.
We were hired by one group of writers who ran the show. They left. A new showrunner came in.
Regime change. Yeah.
And 50% our fault, 50% his fault. I had a partner at the time, and I don't think we quite figured out how to work for him fast enough. And he didn't really give us a chance.
I'm still waiting for the tell-all oral history of Golden Girls. Vulture should get on it. But how do you manage being like, so the leadership of the union, like, I think all unions should aspire to is like run by the members, like,
right.
And you're an active member. You're not paid. You're right. Just another member who has been elected. How do you do that while doing you're still a full-time comedy writer?
Yeah, it's not easy. I think it's important to state that like the day-to-day, managing of the guild is done by paid staff.
Mm-hmm.
The guild union leadership, me and other writers who are elected to the board of directors and the other officer positions, we decide the route that the guild is going to take. We communicate to the members. We have a help of a very hardworking paid staff. So it's not like a 9-to-5 job that I'm doing while I'm also being a comedy writer. On the other hand, we've been engaged in some important campaigns, and it has been very time consuming and tiring. And I'm fortunate that Seth, my boss, is a very supportive member of the guild, and he you know, will cut me a little slack here and there, but I'm still doing that job.
Right.
It's tiring.
that's really funny though, for like him, I don't know, for your boss to be a member of the union that like you report to a member, right?
Right.
And he has working for him the president of the guild. It's like a funny flip.
It is, you know? A funny flip. And that's the other thing too. I mean, I think that our membership has a sort of this wide range of careers and backgrounds. I mean, the kind of writing, you know, obviously there are members of the guild who are movie writers and members of the guild who are game show writers. There are members of the guild, sitcom, drama, some who are showrunners, some who've just gotten their first gig. That's probably the hardest piece of our union is the managing of all the disparate careers that people have and the disparate priorities that each members have, and then finding the commonality, things that affect all of us that we can all get behind.
How do you think the guild like relates to the labor movement generally, right? Because you know, my first impression was, hey, this is like one of the weirdest unions like in the country, right? Mm-hmm. It's all these people writing for TV. It's a very weird kind of work. A lot of people see it as like a celebrity aspect to it, et cetera. But then the longer I've been in it, the more I'm like, oh, wait, the same dynamics are at play here as in other businesses where you've got companies consolidating, real corporate power. They want to drive wages down, et cetera. I don't know. How is it similar? How is it different?
Well, it's similar in what you just said, which is we work for large corporations. They are looking in every way possible to pay us as little as possible. It's not personal. That helps their profit.
Yeah. They're just machines that are built to do that.
Absolutely. It's not personal at all. They want to pay their employees as little as they can get away with.
Right.
The union that we have, we're fortunate in our business that you really can't do anything without writers.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of the lie of reality television. I mean, I watched The Bachelor, which I think is just a great show. Yeah. I really think it's a great.
Oh, it's an incredible production.
It's an incredible production, but somebody's writing some stuff there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but I love that show.
They're creatively conceiving of it, and like they're doing outlines. They're making PDFs to send each other. Here's what's going to happen in this episode for sure.
Right. So we don't have any guild coverage of those shows, but what I'm saying is it's true. The truth of what I'm saying, which is you can't really do any kind of television without writers, any kind of movies without writers. You just can't. Documentaries, everything requires the head of a writer.
Yeah.
And so that gives us our leverage, and that gives us our power, and that's whatever power we have comes from that. And that's similar to other industries, garment workers and automobile workers and
you can't make a car without the people building the car.
Teachers. All the unions have people in them who they – in one way or another, are required. I think that we may have a little more leverage because in some of those other professions, it may be easier to replace people on an automobile assembly line. Not completely easy, but – and so, that's the similar thing. We're a required labor force and we're a skilled labor force. And also, it's different, I think. The way it's different is, you know – when in a lot of other professions, you have people who are, they just need a job to support their family and they're working when and whatever. In being a writer is something you choose to do. Deciding you're going to be a writer, deciding you're going to pursue that career is different than taking a job. in an automobile That's a good factory. Point.
And in a lot of cases, you have to work at it for free for like a decade before you even get your first job.
Right.
As opposed to other unions are jobs where someone, hey, like for instance, we've got hotel hospitality unions here right. here in LA of people who like clean hotels yeah. and stuff. And that's like a, that's more, a much more entry level.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's, and so.
Difficult work, but right. yeah.
So, and so we're different also because finding the solidarity of a union, that's always the hardest thing is making workers understand that their interests lie with the union. And I think when everybody's doing the same job, although I wouldn't say it's easier, it's clearer.
Yeah.
You know, we're all doing this job. We're all working 18 hours a day. That's crazy. We're not getting weekends off. That's crazy. We're getting paid 50 cents an hour. That's crazy. Whatever,
yeah.
You know, whatever that in with writers, as you just said, you work 10 years to break in or however many years it took you to break in. You really feel like you did it mostly by yourself. You may have had mentors, you may have had people who facilitated, gave mm-hmm. you the first break, but you were doing that work. And then you are in that career alone, especially if you're, I think, a movie writer. I think that a movie writer really is on their own, maybe with the help of an agent or a manager, but you know, maybe they knew a producer. But for the most part, that's a real
yeah.
Solitary thing. And then to get to say to that person, your interests lie with this other group of writers, it can be hard, and I think legitimately hard to convince that person that this union is about them too.
Yeah,
many feature writers I think see it easily, see the health insurance, see the residuals and all that. But you know, so when you and I'm not just singling out feature writers. I have plenty of television writers, plenty of other writers who just have to be convinced that their interests lie with the group and that what the group is doing affects them and that or that the sacrifice they may be asked to make
yeah.
is going to help them or it may not help them, but they sort of see in general the strength of the union helps them.
Yeah.
So they're going to, you know, so that I think is the harder thing.
How was
that? And makes it different from other unions.
It makes a difference from some unions, but not all.
Exactly.
And the interesting question for me is how that solidarity was initially built, like when the union started and how it's maintained. Because when you look at, for instance, you know, people are talk about like Uber driver unions, right? And, you know, I remember like a year or two ago in LA, a bunch of rideshare drivers like tried to have a one-day strike, you know, and the problem was, like they had no way to communicate with the other Uber and Lyft drivers, right? And tell them that they were doing it. So like whichever ones were like on the same message board, they all went to LAX and like, right. you know, held up their signs. And I knew about it. So I'm not going to take an Uber and Lyft that day. But, you know, everyone else who just has the app is just opening it and doing it. And I can imagine, you know, in a pre-union era of movie writers, hey, we're all just like getting called up by the producers. None of us know each other. We don't work together. We're all working separately. There's that feeling of, hey, if I leave my job, there's always someone willing to take my place. There's a line, a million of people behind me who would love to do this work. So how does that you create that solidarity?
Well, I mean, it was different when the union started. The union started in the 30s, writers were under contract to studios and they were seeing each other on the studio lot. They would be going into work and working 9 to 5 they would be being handed whatever script the studio wanted them to work on. And so like a big
movie script boiler room, just like, I mean, get on this one. Yeah.
Essentially. And so, I mean, you know, it was also the 1930s was the time of it was the Great Depression, and there was the rise of the radical left. Mm-hmm. Communism was probably the most popular in the 1930s in America than it ever was or would be.
Yeah.
And so radical left writers really organized this union. And it was interesting, the big issue for writers that really formed, that was the beginning of the union, was credit. That the studios would assign credit to whoever they wanted.
Like literally who's in the credits?
Yeah, literally written by.
Yeah.
And so and they could have five writers working on a movie, 50 writers, however many writers they had working on a movie. And the, usually the studio would just look at the last script that was written and say, that's the writer of the movie.
Mm.
And it was really interesting, too, was that writers before the union got to determine credit, and that was really the first big fight, was that the Screenwriters Guild, as it was called then, getting together and demanding collective bargaining and getting the right to determine credit.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, individual writers sort of had these strategies to be the last guy who does the right. And credit was really important. It was even, and what's so interesting about it, it's really kind of a pure thing at the time because it didn't mean more money.
Mm-hmm.
Like this was, again, before residuals, before.
You just want to see your name on it.
And the very sort of practical thing of if you wrote Gone with the Wind,
yeah,
then you probably get another job.
Yeah, right.
And so that's, it was those two things, and it was about your career, but it was also the purity of credit for your creation, along with the practical economic thing of, I want my name on the movie that I created, because that's going to help my career. Then over time, and it was a slow build, and it was tough, but it was a slow build of then starting to demand what are called residuals, payment for reuse of mm-hmm. movies. So, and that really, really came into play in the 50s when television started, and they right. were starting to play movies on television, and writers were starting to work in television, and then this idea of the rerun, which was,
yeah.
again, kind of an old, a relatively new thing in, you know, I mean, it's
the rerun. The rerun was new at one point.
Yeah. And so that idea that you would be compensated again
yeah.
if your work was reused. And that became part of our contract as well. And you know, then the period of the 50s was the time of the blacklist, which is, if anybody needs to know, was the period when if you were thought to be a communist, you couldn't get work.
Yeah.
And 10 writers, the Hollywood 10, were questioned in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee.
In front of Joe McCarthy's committee.
And they went to jail. And these were also people who were also the leadership of the Writers Guild. A lot of them were the people who helped form the Writers Guild, Dalton Trumbo and others there. And there's a interesting thing there as well, because on the one hand, it was about the fear of communism and the mm-hmm. fact that somehow this idea that communism was going to seep into the public through movies. And so there was that fear, but there was also a practical thing from the corporate side, because for the first time, this guild was starting to cut into studio profits.
Mm.
And it just so happens that the leaders of that guild and a lot of the members of the guild at the time, the guild didn't cover all writers. You had to join, but a lot of the people who joined the guild were on the radical left and were being accused mm-hmm. of being communist. So there was this opportunity to sort of decimate the union.
Wow. So like weaponizing that anti-communist fervor just in the name of corporate profits.
I mean, that was a piece of it. It was both. It was, you know, the communist thing was also, I don't want to say that that was just a whole fake thing. I think people really were scared.
Yeah.
But then there was also this sort of corporate benefit from limiting the power of the union. However, during the entire blacklist, and it was a terrible time, a lot of people lost their careers, the guild still kept their power of determining credits.
Mm.
Now, there is it's interesting because they would determine the credit and then the studio would say, well, that writer's a communist. We're not giving him credit. And there's a movie called, I think, A Friendly Persuasion, I don't remember the exact title, that won the Academy Award, I think, 1956 for Best Screenplay, but mm-hmm. has no screenwriter.
It won Best Screenplay?
It won Best Screenplay.
But it has no screenwriter.
Well, now it does, and that's the point I'm making, is that because the guild kept its power and kept determining that when the blacklist ended, they could go back and get those writers the credit they're
doing,
was denied them during the blacklist. And so, but that movie won Best Screenplay, but the studio wouldn't put the one with the writer's name on it. And there was only one writer. It wasn't like he shared it. He wrote the movie.
Yeah.
I think his name was Michael Wilson. Anyway, I think so. But the Guild was damaged. A lot of people had issues with how the Guild conducted itself. It didn't take a strong enough political stance. A lot of writers were hurt. But because it did that work of continually determining credit, it allowed a repair job after the blacklist ended of getting writers their credit back.
And that's a baseline – that's just a baseline piece of dignity to have your name on your work and be respected. And also it's – I think it's a wonderful thing about our business that, you know, at the end of every piece you watch, everybody's name is on, you know, or I mean,
it's very meaningful personally when your name is on something. It's just, it is, it's
it's meaningful for me when I watch our show where I know everybody personally who works on the show and I see all of their names. So I'm like, this is all of us. It's not just, you know, a bunch of randomness. Okay.
Although I do, it's interesting. I do think that it's personal to us, the people who do the work on it. I do have a story though of like I think of how little it means to people in America. There's a movie called Logan's Run.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Very well known movie, which I saw three times in the theater as a kid and never noticed that the screenwriter's name was David Goodman.
Though it was your name
on the screen, big name on the screen. David is a different middle name. David Zelag Goodman. I'm like, how did I miss that? How did my dad, who took me to the movie, miss that? I mean, but you're not reading credits.
But just to the point about that, like it sounds maybe so trivial or like narcissistic, but I think about how I've read about how in the video game industry, for instance, which is going through its own sort of labor awakening to some degree, or at least it's at the very beginning stages. I've read about how the, you know, game companies use credits as like a weapon, against, the people who are working on the games that like, hey, if you take another job, your name won't be on this game. If you like, you know, they work on these games for 5 years. If you leave, you know, early, your name won't be on the game. Or if you don't really pull your weight, your name won't be on the game. Mm-hmm. And like both in terms of those people's like careers, of like wanting to say, I wrote the story for this game, or I led the art team. And then also for their like just emotional connection to their work as being like, you know, creative work, which is always deeply personal. Mm-hmm. It's like that's really sort of heartrending. And it makes so much sense for why that would be one of the very first things you'd want to fight for.
Right. I mean, I think that was probably the thing that was getting writers most angry.
Yeah.
Was this, because I think the other piece of it is it's, you know, as a writer, and you write this thing, and it causes you probably a fair amount of pain, whatever it is, and but you also feel this sort of little bit of joy, and like I solved this problem, or I came up with this idea, or this character, I wrote this dialogue, and then somebody says, this guy who wrote this one line, he's going to get all the credit for everything else, and it's like
right.
And it's still a problem to this day. I mean, it's still a big issue in the Guild, because the way the Guild determines credit is a bunch of writers studios will hire numerous writers. There'll be numerous scripts, and the way credits
like people might not realize when you watch any big blockbuster movie and you see three names maybe written by these three people, maybe a dozen people could have actually
easily contributed,
you know, opened their screenwriting software and at least done something on it.
Exactly. And so the way the credits are determined is that all the drafts get sent to the Guild, and then a group of writers, three writers, read every draft and decide.
Oh my gosh.
Decide who contributed the most. And there are rules, and it's hard, and it's imperfect to say the least.
So there's someone at the Guild who read every draft of Star Wars, of the new Star Wars, the Rise of Skywalker, and knows exactly what went down in the writing of that movie. And like,
there's more than one. There's a group of writers who read all those scripts.
Oh, you should have seen draft three. That was the good one. But then things took a turn.
I don't know that they're making judgments, but
you'd have to be a little bit. But
it was I've done a lot of arbitrations in television. And it's an interesting process because we almost always are in agreement. The writers all read, and it's like it's so clear that this writer contributed the most.
And yeah. This is the person who figured out, oh, the main part of the story, yeah, and right. then it all – yeah,
yeah. Yeah, and everything else is interesting and additive, but it's still this person's creation, or this person added – this major thing, you've got yeah. to give them credit or.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting problem, but again, very imperfect. It's because again, now credit is connected to money. If you get credit on a movie or a television show, that means that's determinative of how much money and residuals you're going to get.
Yeah.
And if you did a lot of work and you don't get credit, you're,
yeah.
You're pissed.
But I also want to talk about, yeah, I think there's a perception that, you know, people know that some writers are paid a lot, right? Oh, J.J. Abrams, you know, nine-figure deal or whatever, right? And there's like a perception of the Writers Guild as you know, representing right. those writers. But then when I go to the meetings, I'm like, well, hold on a second. The things people are talking about are the same things that workers are talking about everywhere. Right. Like talking about healthcare and paid parental leave is right. like one of the big things that comes up at every meeting now, yeah. which is like everybody is in that same yeah. boat with paid parental leave. And, you know, beyond those issues of credit and those sorts of things, like there's so many, you know, I don't want to use the word rank and file, but there's so many like middle class like people in our.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Business who are like being protected by the guild in this way.
Well, I mean, you know, even though you have, again, members like JJ or Seth or who are big earners, the guild isn't there for them.
Yeah.
They've got
agents and managers and lawyers and
well, more importantly, yeah. the guild's creation was about making sure that there was a minimum amount of money that a writer would be paid, that they would get health insurance, that they would get residuals. And that's always been about the middle class writer. The fact is the benefits that the big writers get, we're not negotiating the contract of the companies to protect the interests of our
yeah.
top earners. We're entirely focused on what a new writer makes, what a mid-level writer makes, and making sure that the companies who are making lots of money from that work are properly compensating those writers.
The guild sets the minimum wage, in
essentially,
essence.
Yeah.
And I think it's just fascinating to me because writing is like, you know, TV writing is like a pretty good bit of work to get, you know?
It's great. We're very lucky to get. I mean, I'm, you know, again, my mother was a social worker.
Yeah.
She raised three kids. I never made more than $40,000. Her end salary when she retired in the 80s was 40 grand.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't have a lot of money. We didn't, and she worked her ass off.
Yeah.
I mean, I work hard, but it's a different kind of work, and I get to make things up for a living. And that, I feel so lucky from that perspective.
But it strikes me that, you know, we have this perception, hey, that's a great line of work to be in.
Right.
But it's because of the guild that it is. Like, it could be very bad. I know people who work in reality.
Right.
And they, it's not a nice business to be in, and it's a lot harder to make ends meet, despite the fact that the shows make just as much money.
Yeah, yeah. I think that that's a great point. I think that the leverage that writers bring to bear by being part of the union tries to protect the work environments and the pay, but you know that it's a constant battle. And now now we're entering a period where writers are, it is feeling a little bit more like reality. They're, you know, a lot of the streaming services are doing series. It takes a lot longer to do those services,
right.
and it can keep writers from getting a new job. It can keep writers from earning above the minimum.
Mm-hmm.
The working conditions we're trying to fight the changing working conditions because we want it to be.
Is that downward pressure is constant.
Constant.
Yeah.
Constant.
Well, I want to talk more about how the business is changing, but we got to take a really quick break. We'll be right back with more David Goodman. Okay, we're back with David Goodman. So what is the leverage that the Guild uses in order to fight back against those pressures? Like, where does the power of a union even come from? It's almost like ineffable, like on the wind. Like, sometimes you're trying to figure it out.
No, I mean, it's the only real power a union has is to strike and to threaten a strike. I mean, that's really what it comes down to it. You don't want to do it. You never want to do it, honestly, but sometimes you have to. So for instance, the power of the Writers Guild to stop the flow of product by stopping writing is powerful. It's scary to the companies. They in the lead up to a strike, they start doing everything they can. The lead up to the rumor of a strike.
There's
a rumor that there might be a strike. They start like stockpiling scripts, going to television shows and saying, hey, could you do a couple extra scripts so that if there's a strike, we can shoot some episodes, or going to feature writers and saying, hey, you got any ideas? We'll buy it so we can get the script done, because if there's a strike, then we'll have scripts. Cause the flow of product is very important to them.
Yeah.
And the flow of, again, in the launching of these new streaming services, as an example, new product is paramount. That is, The Mandalorian is what launched Disney Plus.
Right.
You know, I mean, all that other stuff helped.
Yeah.
But The Mandalorian, like, is literally the most popular show in the world, I think. I think it's literally that.
And Watchmen is how HBO is fighting back, right?
Yeah. You know, they're going to look for the new, what's this new product? You know, an HBO Max, which, you know, they're keeping, I think, Friends, and they'll be launching.
That's the other big thing, is whoever has Friends is like winning, right? Whoever's got Friends or South Park or Seinfeld.
I mean, there are some of the, you know, Friends, The Office, those kind of perennial shows that people are still watching because of their Simpsons, because of their brilliance, are meaningful. But it also, in order to drive new subscriptions, you still need new product.
And yeah.
So
you got to see this. I got to sign up. Yeah.
Yes. And so that to me is comparable to historically the Guild's power was we could put a crimp in the launch of the network television season if we went on strike.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an unfortunate, I face conversations with the members all the time. Is like, is there anything else we could do? Is there, and don't we have any other power? And we have some leverage, but when it comes down to it, a union's power is its ability to stop working.
Yeah.
And
I mean, what else is there to do, but right. to say, hey, the deal's not right. good enough. We right. respectfully decline. Right. we're not going to take the offer. And so we're not going to do the work for you.
But the union also has to make sure that its members agree that that's the strategy. That if we stopped work now, we would get what we're asking for. Is what we're asking for realistic? Is this, and so that's always the question. The guild decides. It's an interesting thing. It's sort of where I started this conversation. I don't have any power. I really don't. I only have the role of spokesman. But if the members aren't for it, it's not going
to
happen.
Yeah. If you show up to a meeting and you say, hey guys, I think it would be a good idea if we all went on strike, and everyone just go, boo, we're going back to work tomorrow.
I mean, you're done.
Like you can call a strike as much as you want, but no, you can't force anybody to do anything.
The members have to see that whatever the guild strategies are in their interest. And if they don't, then you're done.
Yeah.
And that's also, part of the problem. I'm not talking now about the Writers Guild. I'm talking about unions in general. Is that because of this downward pressure on wages, because people in so many industries are making less money and having a much harder time, and I mean that they can't even risk the idea of being out of work. So the union loses power, and that's the success of corporate America in demonizing unions and consolidating their power, and that's really a sad state of affairs for workers in general.
Yeah, but it's also there's a little bit of hopefulness in there that if
no,
you're,
Adam, there's no hope.
No, I'm trying to find a positive.
No, I'm sorry, I'm just kidding.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking if you're if you're listening to this and you're a worker as everybody is, right. as every adult person right. is, and you're not in a union and you're not happy about your work,
right.
like there is power and leverage in, if you look around your office, everybody there, well, if you decline to work together.
We've seen it with teachers in, was it Alabama? We saw teachers who...
teachers in LA went on strike this year,
I think the Alabama teachers weren't unionized.
Yeah,
and they went on strike, and I don't know that they're unionized still, but they were making so little money, and so they saw they had they were all being oppressed, they were all not being paid for the work,
and their students were being hurt. It was hurting the state,
and there was a lot of both support in the state, but national support. And that's the beginning of unions again. It's like we're going through another cycle where, because unions have been decimated, now workers are suffering and they're seeing there's power in working together.
Yeah.
And so, yes, that's the hopefulness. I feel like we've been on a downward trend in unions in this country, but then it will swing up again because workers will unite again.
Yeah.
And they will see that being in a union works to the individual's advantage, and that and that's where all unions started. It starts with a group of workers deciding our interests are aligned and we've got to fight together.
Yeah. I read a really interesting framing of this. I think it was Hamilton Nolan, who's writes about labor issues a lot, described it as that for decades corporate America decided it wanted to have labor peace, that, work conditions for workers were so bad. You had strikes all over the country that debilitated the country. You had, massive unionization. Right. And then it was, a lot of times it was scary. It stopped, the economy a lot. And it was such a problem right. that, corporate America was like, okay, let's have peace, right? Let's make a deal with these workers
right.
and all these different industries, auto industry, right. entertainment industry, so many industries, that gave them a fair deal. deal, right? And over the last couple decades, they've decided, actually, we don't want to do that anymore. We don't want peace. We're okay pissing the workers off. We're okay diminishing wages. If it makes people angry, it makes them angry. We'd rather have more profits. And now we're starting to see unrest again. That
I don't know who that writer is. I think that your presentation and that analysis really takes out the fact that workers really showed their power.
Mm-hmm.
They showed the kind of power that they had, so that whether or not corporations wanted peace or not, it didn't matter because these unions had power.
Yeah.
And were using their power. And so what's happened is there's been a diminishing of that. I really, since the Reagan administration, there's been an assault on unions, so that unions in general represent now a much smaller group of workers.
Yeah.
All these right to work states now, which are right to work is just an awful lie.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not right to work. It's, you know, it's we're going to kill the union state.
Yeah, it's an abridgment of the right to form a group that represents you and to have solidarity.
Right. So, and those were all, but they put it in this thing of right to work, so it makes it sound like it's in the workers' interest when it's not.
Yeah.
And this has hurt the leverage of unions across the country, and workers, unfortunately, now are sort of having to find their way back to understanding the power of collective bargaining.
When you said that, you know, the union's real power is when it goes on strike or when it withholds, you know, its work.
Or the threat of a strike.
The threat of a strike, yeah. What are the, you know, what are the gains that, you know, the Writers Guild has made through going on strikes over the years?
Well, in 1960, there's a strike that gave us our health benefits, which is like
thank you to those writers who went on strike for giving me my health benefits.
And there's always sacrifice. The writers in that union gave up residuals on the entire library that existed before 1960. So those writers gave up money. There's always sacrifice.
Wow.
And that was part of the deal. We're giving that up. We're giving up the money on all that entire library so that going forward, members will have health insurance.
Wow. Amazing. Really?
Amazing. And so the most recent strike in 2007 was about the internet, and writers during that strike made personal sacrifices. The deals were canceled. They gave up work, and then it timed out with a big economic downturn. So a lot of those jobs didn't come back after the strike, not because of the strike, but because it was the huge economic downturn in the country. But we got coverage of the internet, and now between 20% and 30% of our members work on television shows and feature films that are streamed that wouldn't be covered if we hadn't gone on strike.
And that was in 2007 that the Guild saw that coming.
And it's a really, you know, I remember I had just been elected to the board, and I remember other leadership and staff trying to explain to me that people were going to be watching television shows on their computer. And I'm like, no, it's not going to happen. And then people telling me, describing smart televisions, like there's going to, your computer and your television are going to be one and the same. And I'm like, no. And, you know, I didn't.
It's a good thing you weren't making all the decisions then.
Absolutely not. But I'm like, no, but all right. If we have to, I believe them. I believe they're being sincere. I just couldn't picture it.
Yeah. And Hulu launched like the next year.
Hulu launched the day the strike ended.
Really?
Yeah. No, the companies knew what was happening. Obviously the companies were planning. That's why they made us take a strike. That's the other piece of this is that, you know, we said we wanted coverage of the internet. The companies took a gamble that we wouldn't be able to hold together and that they might be able to get the internet for free. And because they all had corporate plans about streaming, about, you know, the idea that it's so hard to remember that, like, when you loaded a video off the internet back then, it could take forever to load a 5-minute video.
Yeah.
And so the idea that you could think that they're going to be making television shows for the internet doesn't seem possible.
Yeah.
The technology didn't seem – you couldn't – and then obviously the streaming thing just started getting better and better and better and happened so fast.
Yeah.
And the companies were working on it. And so thank God – the leadership and the staff of the guild was too. That's
right.
What we're seeing in the future, because we'd be so screwed now if we hadn't gone on strike in 2007.
Wow. People ask me about the agency campaign. They say they've read a little bit about it, and they say, what?
America's read a little about it? I mean, do you think really that people listening to this podcast have any idea what this is?
Perhaps they have not. Like, if they follow me on Twitter, they'll occasionally see me tweet about it. Like, my friends from home are like, what the hell is going on? Can you explain it in 30 seconds?
I'll try.
Yeah.
Our agents, the way agents used to operate in the old days was they would take 10% of a client's income for helping them get a job and negotiating their deal. Over the years, the agents have developed, their companies have grown, and they've started doing something called, they would get a packaging fee from the studio. And this is instead of taking commission from the client. And as a result, this packaging fee, which was associated with representing the client but was not being paid by the client, was being paid by our employers to our agents.
Yeah.
The agencies got rich. These big they've become big companies themselves. They've also – a couple of them have started producing. And as a result of that, the clients they're representing's income has declined.
Mm-hmm.
Our income as writers has declined over the last 20 years, 25%. And I'm not even taking cost of living. I'm saying actual decline.
Wow.
And so we realized we needed to address this. So last year, the Guild, again, it was all about reaching out to the members and explaining this to them and saying we really feel like we need to fire any agent that is going to be taking these fees and going to engage in these conflicts of interest, because the idea that an agency could be producing television and movies is a conflict of interest, because if your agent is your employer, they're not your agent anymore.
Yeah. I remember when I finally understood the issue, like my own boiled down version of it is like the Guild is by law the only body that can like allow agents to work for writers, right? We grant the ability to agents, because the union is, you know, by law negotiates on behalf of writers, but the union says, hey, the agents can do everything other than the minimums, everything other than scale. And so the question is, should a labor union give the right to negotiate for its workers to people who are being paid by the bosses? Does that make sense?
That's essentially right.
For the labor union. and clearly no. So we withdrew that right and said, okay, you can no longer represent a writer if you're being paid by the bosses of the writer.
I don't know why you asked me to explain it. You explain it so much better.
Thank you. Well, I do my best. It's an interesting battle, because it's not a battle with the bosses directly. It's with these other bodies that work in the industry. But in the same way, those big agencies have been buying each other. They've been taking on these massive investments, and they're trying to hoard power in the business. And so it's been a long battle with this, you know, these sort of like major forces of capitalism. How you feel it's been going? Well,
yeah, it has. I mean, it's tough.
Yeah,
I mean, all, you know, at the beginning of this process, all the agencies were unified against us. Now many of the mid-size and smaller agencies have signed, have negotiated with the Guild a new agreement, have signed it, are representing writers again.
And they'll no longer have those conflicts of interest. Right. They're no longer paid by the bosses.
And writers, some writers are still, I think, upset that they're not with their agents. And that's something we take very seriously. The many writers have found other representation, whether it be managers or lawyers. And then the question remains, when are these big four agencies, who are the sort of the remaining agencies who haven't signed, when and if they will make a deal with us? You know, there have been discussions. I don't have an answer to that right now, but I think writers – In the majority of the members of the Guild thought this was – the overwhelming majority of the members of the Guild thought this was a fight we needed to take on. And, again, the overwhelming majority are still for it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we never fully agree on anything, and I don't dismiss the people who are against it either. I have to keep a close watch on how the members are feeling about this and yeah. do everything we can to resolve it.
Well, that brings up one of what I think is sort of one of the core conflicts or core questions I have about unions in general, because you're always going to have – look, as you say, the strength of the union is its membership, and the membership feeling the same way about something right. and putting their money where their mouths are and fighting for that thing. But you're always going to have people who disagree, right? I remember one thing that really stuck with me, one writer wrote an op-ed somewhere about how they didn't agree with the agency campaign. And they said, I just don't like being in clubs and I don't like other people telling me what to do, right? And I'm like, hey, I can't argue with that. I can't tell that person that they're wrong to right. say, I don't want to be in this club. Yeah. I didn't sign up to be, but I have to be. Right. And I don't like it telling me what to do. That is a little bit of a, you know, through another lens, a core American value of like, no one should get to tell you what to do. Right. right. And so how do you think about that as, you know, a person who's the leader of that group that like, you're always going to have folks who feel like, hey, what the fuck is this? Why do I have to be a part of this at all?
I mean, that's a tough thing to deal with. I think that what I try to do with anybody like that is a reminder of the things they have gotten from being part of that group. Mm-hmm. As you just reacted to the strike that happened in 1960 that gave us health insurance. Mm. The health insurance that gets transferred from one employer to another. Like I can work for every studio in town. They all pay into my health fund. They all pay into my pension. I don't have to have 15 different accounts. And that's all part of being part of that club. That because you write a movie or a TV show and you get money if it's rerun, that's from being part of that club.
Yeah.
And so trying to make people understand that there's real benefits that wouldn't exist. And again, I think there are writers, actors, directors who would be giant successes without being part of their union. But the overwhelming majority of our members
yeah.
have gotten some substantial benefits from being part of the union. And that's the conversation I try to have. I don't convince everybody.
For sure. And I don't expect you to, you know, it's just, and I understand why you think about it in terms of that day-to-day conversation with right. those members. But I also like, there's a philosophical question as well of like, there's this idea that as Americans, like we should always have the ability to make any choice we want at any time, which is obviously not true in daily life, right? you know,
well, I'm constantly faced with the hypocrisy of the self-made American businessman, which
yeah.
who relied on the U.S. Post Office, the U.S. road system, the U.S. education system, all the things that America gives everybody or tries to give everybody. There's nobody self-made.
Yeah.
You know, and so that idea that I shouldn't have to pay taxes because I did it on my own. No, you didn't do it on your own. It's a lie. That's a lie.
Yeah.
And that's most of the members of the guild, I think, understand that they got something from being a member of the guild. And that is our strength, that most yeah. of our members – I think even almost all of our members recognize that there's a positive association with their own lives and careers because the guild existed.
Yeah. The comparison to taxes is a really good one. That's a similar thing where like, why should I have to pay this just for existing?
Right.
I heard an interview. This stuck with me so long. Interview with Doug Stanhope, who's a great comic, libertarian. He was interviewed on Mark Maron's show years ago. And he said something, I'm going to paraphrase, but it was like the question of being a libertarian is, did I come into this world owing anybody anything? Right. And I was like, oh, that is a really good question. He feels like he doesn't. That's like a feeling of his heart.
Right.
I can understand that. I disagree, because if you're if your mom drove to the hospital on a public road, then you do,
right?
Right? Then you then I'm sorry, I'm gonna ask you to chip in for the road, if that's how you came into the world,
well,
dude.
I guess the doctor would be paid, but the doctor wouldn't have any place to work.
Yeah, like, yeah, exactly.
You know, hospitals are things that exist because other people put them together. I mean, maybe if you were born in your mother just.
Yeah. Or were you born at a state university hospital like I was, for example? I believe so. I think I believe I was. Again, for the folks who are listening to this show, thinking about their own workplaces and thinking about what they can maybe take from the Guild's example, or just from your thinking about, labor issues in this country to their own places. Like, what do you have to say to them?
Well, I mean, don't listen to what a company says about a union.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is the biggest one. I think that don't listen to. I mean, this. I'm sorry. Don't listen to what the Republican Party says about unions.
Mm.
I they're not being honest. I think to me, so on the one hand, you've got to sort of push all that noise aside and sort of look at your workplace, look at the other people in your workplace and decide, is there power with us getting together? And don't, and it's a tough thing forming a union. I've never had to form a union. So that idea of starting from a place of having to form a union, I have such enormous respect for the people who do it, who stand up and say.
And there are people doing it all over the country now.
Yes. And to me, it's like they're real heroes, they're not just out for themselves. They understand they're out for a lot of other people. And so, and if, you're in a union, if you're in a union, I think the most important thing that was said to me was from I have a cousin who was a union organizer for the Communication Workers Union. And when I joined the Guild, when I got my first job as a writer, and she lives out here, and she became their chief legal counsel and a strong union person, she told me a union is the only bureaucracy in your life that you can have some control over.
Mm.
And she said that to me. I didn't quite know what she meant, honestly. Because again, you think of the unions as you can think of your union as kind of like the DMV. It's like this thing and it's out there and it's like, I got to deal with it, but I really don't want to and never want to go there, whatever. But it's not. A union is this organic thing made up of people. And you can, if you get involved, you can really affect change. That has been my experience.
I've noticed that as well, just from showing up at meetings.
Yeah.
And first of all, it's democracy in action. It literally matters in the room when we're talking about the agency campaign or striking or anything else. How do the people in the room feel?
Absolutely.
Are they applauding for the idea of, being tougher? Or are they applauding for the idea of taking it easy?
Right.
And that has a real effect. And then, if you show up to enough things, you'll just start getting asked to be on committees and shit.
and do work
and make
for free.
Decisions. Yeah. But those decisions affect people.
You're a great union member.
I love
seeing you in meetings.
Oh, that's okay. I'm going to end on that note because it made me feel warm and fuzzy. Thank you so much for coming on, David.
Oh, thank you, Adam.
I appreciate it. Well, thank you so much to everybody for listening. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with David Goodman as much as I did. That is it for us this week on Factually. I want to thank our producer, Dana Wickens, our researcher, Sam Roudman, our engineer, Ryan Connor, and Andrew WK for our theme song. You can follow me everywhere you want at Adam Conover. Sign up for my mailing list or check out my tour dates at adamconover.net. And until then, I'll see you next week on Factually. Thanks so much for listening.
That was a HeadGum Podcast. Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, wherever you get your podcasts.